This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden held his first news conference Thursday on his 65th day in office, fielding most questions on immigration, specifically about the government's treatment of child migrants at the southwestern border with Mexico. Media reports say children are being housed in overcrowded conditions, which Biden called unacceptable. On the international front, when asked about apparent short-range ballistic missile launches by North Korea Thursday into Asian waters, Biden said the United States is consulting with allies and partners, and there will be responses if they choose to escalate, adding, "We will respond accordingly." Meantime, North Korea's state news agency reported on Friday that it had launched a newly developed type of tactical guided projectile on Thursday. The announcement came as the United States condemned the launch and warned of a threat of international peace, warned of a threat to international peace and security. The launches, which were Pyongyang's first ballistic missile test in nearly a year, underscored steady progress in its weapons program amid stalled denuclearization talks with the United States. Final election results show Israel in a political deadlock once again, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his opponents falling short of a governing majority. The Election Commission says, with 100% of votes counted, that Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party and his natural allies have won 52 seats in the 120-seat Knesset, Israel's parliament. Ideology diverse array of parties committed to ousting him won 57 seats. For more news, join us at voanews.com via remote. This is VOA News. Officials in the southwestern U.S. state of Texas raised the death toll from the February winter storm and blackouts to at least 111 people. That's nearly double the state's initial tally, following one of the worst power outages in U.S. history. Texas health officials say most of the deaths are associated with hypothermia. Many homes went without power or drinkable water for days after sub-freezing temperatures, failing power plants, and record demand for heat pushed the state's electric grid to the breaking point. Texas officials had put the initial tally of deaths at 57, but warned it would increase. 5 straight days of insistent rains triggered the worst floods in Australia's most populous state of New South Wales in more than a half century, cutting off entire towns and washing away homes, farms, and livestock. The extreme weather has affected 40% of the population. Aerial footage on Friday showed surfboards, tires, debris floating near submerged properties as floodwaters remain extremely high. 2,000 people remain in rescue shelters. Many have only ruins to return to now. Conditions have eased over the last 2 days, but evacuation warnings remained on Friday for hundreds of low-lying properties along the coast of New South Wales as rivers stayed above the danger level. The first batch of COVID-19 vaccines arrived in South Sudan's Juba International Airport Thursday. The 132,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine will be offered first to healthcare workers, including doctors and nurses, along with other vulnerable groups, free of charge. Confidence in the AstraZeneca vaccine had plunged across Europe after recent reports that a small number of recipients had developed unusual blood clots amid a coronavirus wave on the continent. So far, more than 15 African countries have received COVID-19 vaccines in recent weeks. As Mexico approaches 200,000 confirmed deaths from the COVID-19 virus, President Andres Manuel López Obrador is preparing to call out more military, state, and local personnel to spur the vaccination effort as more doses arrive. López Obrador said he views it as a race against time to get all people over 60 vaccinated with at least one dose by the end of April before a possible third wave hits. By remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, March 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There's a standoff in Liberia between the justice ministers and the national police.
I am not aware of any order from the Ministry of Justice. We have 48 hours available to us. In the 48 hours, the suspect must be charged to court. If not, he or she must be released.
Somalia warns foreign diplomats against interference in Somalia's domestic affairs. A 220,000-ton cargo ship continues to block passage through the Suez Canal in Egypt. And access to COVID-19 vaccines in Africa remains a challenge.
The momentum just have started must be kept up to widen the scope of COVID-19 vaccination beyond the high-risk group that have been prioritized by many countries.
And as the late Tanzanian President John Magufuli is being laid to rest today, will his successor break with his leadership style? Those stories, plus Samson Omale's sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's Justice Minister Frank Musa Dean has ordered the immediate release from detention of the former ruling Unity Party Secretary General. Police arrested Mohamed Ali for making alleged terrorist threats against the National Elections Commission and an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Rita Jilabwe has details from Monrovia.
Police had given Mohamed Ali 48 hours to report to police headquarters and answer questions about the threats he allegedly made in a Facebook post. But Ali was arrested Thursday soon after he and his lawyers arrived at the police headquarters and charged with terrorist threats, arson, and attempted murder. In a statement, Thursday Justice Minister Frank Musa Dean said Section 22.2B of the new Executive Law of Liberia empowers the Minister of Justice to institute all legal proceedings necessary for the law enforcement. He therefore ordered the immediate release of Mr. Ali, in keeping with said law. The Justice Minister said the Liberian National Police should produce proper evidence to support the charges against Mr. Ali. He says until such evidence is produced, reviewed, and determined by the Attorney General, for police should release Mr. Ali. But police spokesperson Moses Carter says Mr. Ali will remain in detention because the police are not aware of the Justice Minister's directives.
I am not aware of any order from the Ministry of Justice. I am not aware of any order from the Minister of Justice.
Carter says Mohamed Ali will be imprisoned for 2 days before his case is heard by a judge of the court.
We have 48 hours available to us. In the 48 hours, the suspect must be charged to court. If not, he or she must be released.
Meanwhile, Unity Party National Chairperson Amin Modat says the arrest of Mr. Ali was a predetermined action by the police and that the charges levied against Mr. Ali are politically motivated.
It is the responsibility, we do not deny that, of the police or the government of calling him to question him. But there hasn't been an investigation. There hasn't been any indictment up to the point where he was arrested. And the crime that he's being arrested for, attempt to commit murder. Come on.
Mr. Moda says the arrest of the party's secretary general is an attempt to silence opposition criticisms of the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change.
We believe that this is unfair. This is a total disrespect by law. And again, it's a real attempt by the powers that be to subjugate the opposition and silence any kind of statements or contravening opinion.
Mr. Ali has been undergoing investigations for his two social media posts against the National Elections Commission and an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of Liberia. His posts have been deemed as threats by security because the Elections Commission headquarters and the home of an Associate Justice were petrol-bombed following his post. Rita Jirabwe, VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
Somalia has warned diplomats in the country against interference in Somalia's domestic affairs after international partners, including the UN, the EU, and the US, called for speeding up delayed elections. Mohamed Kahir talks to analysts and reports from Mogadishu on the growing tension.
The federal government of Somalia has called on diplomats in the country not to interfere in the country's internal political affairs. The notice by the Information Minister Osman Dube comes after representatives of various entities, including the U.S., the EU and UN office in Somalia, said they will not support a possible or partial term extension for Somalia's current president. Dube said his government expects its international partners to respect Somalia's sovereignty and territorial integrity within the principles of the international law. He added that it's illegal to intervene in a sovereign state's internal issues, calling it a red line that must never be crossed. The government of President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, popularly known as Farmajo, is facing international pressure to conduct the elections. Disputes over electoral process have held up the polls, and the talks between various political stakeholders to end the standoff have yet to bear any fruits. Meanwhile, the president's term officially expired last month, and the opposition groups say he no longer has a mandate to run the government. Political analyst Mohamed Moussa Adan says the strong comments from the international community were expected because Farmajo's administration failed to utilize its mandate during its term in office to plan for transparent polls.
Actually, the role of the international community for pressuring the Somali actors in conducting the elections is very crucial, especially in this period when the electoral impasse creates uncertainties. Although historically they used to play similar roles in helping the stakeholders to come together and chart out peaceful and inclusive electoral processes, this time round, their influence and presence is more critical.
Mohamed Matan is a senior lecturer of international relations at the University of Somalia. He says the international community has invested in Somalia's recovery process and has a say when things are not going in the right direction. He says international relations are based on economy, security and the law. Therefore, it's not right for Somalia through the minister to run against the interference. He added that, in his opinion, the comments by the diplomats in the country about the delayed elections were not against the sovereignty of the nation. They were for the norms of international relations. Meanwhile, UN envoy James Swan has held meetings with Somali state leaders in the past week in an effort to iron out the differences. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Egypt's Suez Canal authorities were making further attempts on Thursday to reopen the waterway after unsuccessful attempts to move a 220,000-ton cargo ship that has been blocking the canal since Wednesday and temporarily suspending navigation. Edward Urania reports from Cairo.
With shipping traffic stalled for yet another day Thursday, Egypt's Suez Canal Authority continues to work against the clock to try and refloat a gigantic container ship that remains stuck. Usama Rabia, who heads the Suez Canal Authority, told Egyptian TV that tugboats are trying to maneuver the nearly 400-meter Ever Given so that it is able to move once again. He says weather conditions were responsible for the incident. The canal authority, he says, always tries to anticipate sand or wind storms so that ships are not likely to suffer damage from bad weather conditions. Some ships, he notes, were allowed to remain in one of the canal's lakes to remain safe. The container ship is longer than the width of the Suez Canal at the point where the vessel became wedged. Some sources say a wind gust was responsible for pushing the ship into the side of the canal. The Japanese company that runs the ship apologized to Egypt Thursday for creating a massive traffic jam. The vessel, which carries approximately 20,000 shipping containers, making it one of the largest in the world, can be destabilized by gusts of wind due to the number of containers stacked on top of each other. Paul Sullivan, who is a professor at the Washington-based U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA that the current traffic jam on the Suez Canal, which is responsible for 12% of world trade, is likely to be a difficult and costly situation.
It is not going to be an easy operation. It's probably going to be an expensive one. It's already very expensive because so many ships have been blocked from going through More than likely, there will be massive lawsuits from other shipping companies, and people expected their goods and parts to arrive on time.
Sullivan points out that unless canal authorities were negligent in advising the ship, Egypt is not likely to be responsible for what happened.
I don't think Egypt would be responsible for it unless some connection can be proven to not directing the ship properly or not mentioning the sandstorm coming through. But the real responsibility is going to be on the part of the ship itself. And Egypt will most likely fine that shipping company and the people involved in this incident a very large sum.
Egypt earns between $5 and $6 billion each year in revenues from the Suez Canal. Sullivan says this is a great embarrassment to Egypt, and it is losing massive amounts in Suez Canal revenues from the current blockage. Arab media are reporting that the Suez Canal Authority has requested assistance from a company in the Netherlands, destination of the Ever Given, to help refloat the ship. VOA could not independently confirm the information. Oil prices have reportedly risen about $5 a barrel due to the blockage of the canal. Around 50 ships a day pass through the Suez Canal, but most traffic is hunkering down at various locations along the waterway. Many ship crews are reportedly very tired since host ports have not allowed them to leave their vessels because of the coronavirus pandemic. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, March 26. The World Health Organization says Africa is lagging in the race to vaccinate its people against the deadly coronavirus. The WHO says Africa needs far greater access to COVID-19 vaccines to reach its goal of vaccinating 60% of the population by June 2022. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Africa received its first delivery of vaccines from the COVAX vaccine-sharing facility a month ago. Health officials say this has kick-started robust vaccination campaigns throughout much of the continent. Richard Mahigo is an immunization and vaccine development program coordinator at the WHO Regional Office for Africa. He says 32 countries currently are vaccinating high-risk groups against COVID-19. So far, he notes, nearly 7.7 million doses have been administered.
This is indeed a good start. Even if the continent has received only limited doses and much later than other regions of the world. The momentum just have started must be kept up to widen the scope of COVID-19 vaccination beyond the high-risk group that have been prioritized by many countries.
Mahigo warns this will not be possible unless vaccine equity becomes a reality. He says it is unfair for some high-income countries to vaccinate their entire populations while ignoring the needs of poorer nations. WHO estimates Africa will need nearly 1.5 billion vaccine doses to protect 60% of the continent's 1.2 billion population by June 2022. Another challenge facing Africa is the new coronavirus mutant strains. Mahigo says at least 15 African countries have reported the presence of variant strains. He says it is important to monitor the evolution of the new strains and to maintain public health measures such as masks and social distancing.
All the measures that were proven really effective in preventing the transmission should continue to be done. By increasing the vaccination capacity, we will put less pressure on the virus and avoid its mutation, as we have heard. So this is the only solution that we can have to get out of this situation.
Mahigo says WHO is exploring different ways of boosting the vaccine supply through the COVAX facility. One possible solution, he says, is to collaborate with rich countries and test their willingness to share surplus doses with Africa. Another is to promote technology transfer and reduce intellectual property barriers so vaccines can be produced locally. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The late Tanzanian President John Pombe Magufuli, who died last Wednesday from heart complications, will be laid to rest today, Friday, in his hometown of Chato. Critics of the late president are hoping that his crackdowns on press freedom and opposition, as well as his coronavirus denial, have gone with him to his grave. Magufuli is being succeeded by Samia Suluhu Hassan, Tanzania's first female president. As Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam, it is not yet clear if Suluhu Hassan will carry on Magufuli's authoritarian leaning style of leadership.
Tanzania has undergone a smooth transition process following the death of President John Magufuli early in his second term. Former Vice President Samia Suluhu Hassan has taken over as the sixth president of Tanzania and will finish out Magufuli's term, which ends in 2025. The new leadership will be passing through a period of filling the gaps that were mostly criticized during Magufuli's term. Speaking at Magufuli's funeral, the new president told Tanzanians there's nothing to worry about. Let me say something here, she said. For those who have doubts that this woman, if can handle being a president, I want to tell them that the one who is standing here in front of you is the president of Tanzania. Opposition politicians such as James Mbatia, the chairperson of the National Convention for Construction and Reform, say that if the new president will cooperate with the opposition, there'll be no tension between them and the ruling party. Last year's general election left big scars in the history of multi-party system in Tanzania, Mbatia says. He says the election hurt people, people died, and others were denied their rights. He says people started to preach opposition is enemy, while we had already moved from there. He asked that the best way to help Samia Suluhu to get out of this deep hostility is to have a reconciliation table, because we are not here due to hostility or to disrupt the country. If she uses her political will, he says, I think this can be achieved. During Magufuli's time in office, human rights activists criticized him for suppressing dissent and freedom of expression. Rights activists like Kumbusho Kagine say the new administration must allow reopening of debate and public space. In the previous leadership, we criticized a lot on issues concerning suppression of human rights, he says. But for a period of 5 years, there has been the enactment of oppressive laws that suppress rights activists, media, and social media users. That was the main thing, that is them criticize Magufuli's leadership, he says. What we expect that Samia's leadership will do, and we'll also be vocal on that, is to remove all oppressive laws, he says. Since 2015, Tanzania enacted strict laws on cybercrimes and media services. The laws allow authorities to directly suspend media outlets and charge journalists with sedition for publishing material deemed misleading, false, or threat to peace. Journalists hope that, under the president, they can do their jobs freely. Sophia Malaki is a freelance journalist in Tanzania. Malaki says the new president should ensure journalists have freedom so that they can reveal challenges in the society and speak out. She says she believes her son will hear them. Malaki adds that there are some people who think that when a journalist writes a critical story, they are the opposition. It's nothing like that, she says. Tanzanian citizens are waiting to see how their new president chooses to lead the country. Many believe that the leadership style of President Hassan will be in sharp contrast to that of the late Magufuli. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
As global health officials work to draw attention to tuberculosis amid this week's World TB Day, treatment for patients around the world dropped dramatically amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Michael Rich, a TB expert and physician with Partners in Health, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the search, treat, prevent measures that need to be put in place.
Probably there are two primary reasons why there's a decrease in reduction. And the first one would be that people are just more reluctant to go to health centers because they're afraid to catch COVID. And especially in many African countries. And then there are also some lockdown restrictions that result in them not going to the health centers as often.
With South Africa having at 41%, one of the biggest differences in reduction in treatment for the year of 2020, do you think that's because the fact that they had kind of a more severe lockdown or a higher cases of COVID than some other countries on the continent?
I don't know the specifics around it, but I can't imagine that they have a very high burden of TB, and they also ended up having a high burden of COVID and pretty strict lockdowns. So both of those probably played a role into this affecting South Africa disproportionately to maybe other African countries.
That was Dr. Michael Rich, a spokesperson for UNHCR's West and Central Africa office. You are speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with a look at the qualifying matches for the Total African Cup of Nations being played across the continent this week. Comoros qualify for the Total African Cup of Nations for the very first time in their history after picking a point in a 0-0 draw with Togo at home on Thursday in Group G. The final whistle drew wild celebrations in the stadium, players and coaches hugging, jumping and dancing as the reality of playing at Africa's biggest competition dawned on them. The result in Maroni sees Comoros move to 9 points ahead of their final match against Egypt, and this means the worst they can finish is second spot. Seven-time champions Egypt joined Comoros in qualifying for next year's AFCON in Cameroon from Group G after a 1-1 draw in Nairobi. In Group D, Gambia's Scorpions qualified also for the very first time for AFCON after a slim 1-0 victory over Angola in Banjul on Thursday. The victory sees Gambia move to 10 points with one round of matches left. Meanwhile, Gabon joined other nations who have qualified for AFCON from the same Group D after a well-worked 3-0 victory over DR Congo at the Stade de la Renovation de Franceville. And now to Group J, where Libya's first match at home in close to 7 years ended in defeat as they lost 5-2 to Tunisia at the Martyrs of Minena Stadium to see their hopes of fighting for qualification to next year's Total African Cup of Nations come to an end. But the drama in Group J was in Malabo, where captain Emilio Nunes Lopez struck a goal in the 90th minute at the Estadio de Malabo as Equatorial Guinea beat Tanzania 1-0 to qualify. Tanzania had hoped to hold on for a point and give themselves hope heading into the final match of the group, but defeat now means their journey to attaining back-to-back AFCON qualifications has come to an end. Staying with the AFCON qualifiers, Rwanda Amavubi went second in Group F with a precious 1-0 home win over Mozambique to revive their qualification hopes to next year's continental showpiece. Automatically qualified as host, Cameroon tops the group on 10 points and faces Cape Verde on Friday in Praia. Burkina Faso joined the list of nations that have qualified for next year's AFCON after a barren draw against Uganda in Kampala on Wednesday that saw them retain top spot in Group B. The Stallions are on 9 points, one ahead of Uganda and two ahead of Malawi, with the two sides playing against each other in their final group day match next week. Malawi's Flames have meanwhile reignited their hopes of qualifying after a slim 1-0 away victory over South Sudan in Khartoum. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, March 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.